This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Neil Patrick Harris has the distinction of having started his career playing one of the more preposterous characters on TV, a brilliant and lovable teenage doctor named Doogie Howser. Doogie Howser, M.D., ran from 1989 to 93. The second season was recently released on DVD. Where do you go after playing Doogie? Harris took a surprising turn into music theater. He performed in the Stephen Sondheim revenge musical Sweeney Todd and starred in a production of Rent. He's been in several films. Probably his most memorable role was his funny cameo as himself in Harold and Kumar Go to White Castle. Now Harris is back on TV in the CBS sitcom How I Met Your Mother. The show is set in the future. The framing device is that the main character, Ted, is telling his children the story of how he met their mother. The story picks up with flashbacks set in 2005 when the father and his friends were in their 20s. Harris plays the obnoxious friend Barney. Here's a scene from the series pilot. Barney is calling Ted on his cell phone.
Hey, so you know how I've always had a thing for half-Asian girls? Well, now I've got a new favorite. Lebanese girls. Lebanese girls are the new half-Asians.
Hey, you want to do something tonight?
Okay, meet me at the bar in 15 minutes and suit up!
Where's your suit? Just once, when I say suit up, I wish you'd put on a suit.
I did, that one time.
It was a blazer.
Neil Patrick Harris, welcome to Fresh Air. How would you describe your role on How I Met Your Mother?
I'm sort of the awful friend that you have and don't really know why you have. He's sort of the know-it-all about women, yet he doesn't really date them very much. He just sort of wants to play the field and be absolutely non-committal towards any commitment. He's the commitment-phobe, womanizing other friend. He's sort of the Larry from Three's Company.
A bit Jim from Taxi. Now, I thought that after Stark Raving Mad, you insisted you'd never do a TV sitcom again. Why did you change your mind?
Well, insist is a tough word. I don't know. I was interested in doing television again, having done a lot of theater in New York for the past 3 years or so. If nothing more than the financial benefits of television are much stronger than the theater at the moment. And I was looking forward to being home in Los Angeles where I live. So I looked into television, and, you know, when you do a pilot season, which is what it's called when you're just trying to get on a new show, happens every January, February, you read a lot of scripts and you see whether you're interested or not. And there were some one-hour things that were good, but then came along this bizarre little half-hour comedy. And the structure's a little bit different on the show. It's sort of like one big flashback, one big yarn told by a middle-aged Ted about his crazy 20s in 2005. And I thought that that structure was good. And then I read Barney, who was just such a crazy guy in the pilot episode. He is insisting on playing laser tag. He always dresses in suits and ties. He's obsessed with Lebanese girls. And it just seemed so strange and funny that I went and met with the guys and was just kind of insane in the audition and ended up getting the job.
Now you're best known to many people from the role that you had when you were in your teens as Doogie Howser, but you've had a really interesting music theater career since then. You've sung three Stephen Sondheim roles. You were in Sweeney Todd, Assassins, and a musical written for television that Sondheim did called Evening Primrose. How did you get your first Sondheim role?
I was in the musical Rent. That was the first big musical thing that I did in L.A.
This wasn't the Broadway production. This was the L.A. production.
The second national tour, Michael Greif directed it in La Jolla, where he was artistic director, and then it moved to the Amundsen Theater in L.A. and played for a while. It was sort of the first leg of the tour. And some people who had seen me in Rent were doing just a concert version of Sweeney Todd at the Amundsen with Kelsey Grammer and Christine Baranski in the leads, and they thought I'd be right for Tobias, which is a role in Sweeney Todd. And so I ended up doing that. Stephen Sondheim came to see that and thought I would be good to do another concert version of Sweeney Todd for the New York Philharmonic, that Patti LuPone and George Hearn ended up starring in.
So the first Sondheim role that you sang, the first production of Sweeney Todd that you did, you had not yet met Sondheim. But subsequent to that, you did meet him. And I don't know how much of a chance you had to talk about the scores that you were singing. But did he give you any useful insights into his writing that helped you as a singer?
Steve and I became friends less through the work we were doing together and more through our mutual love of games and puzzles. He's a gamesman, and I love me some puzzles and murder mysteries and that sort of that genre, and he does too. So we started talking about computer games and crosswords, and he used to do a big thing where he'd have people come to his house and he'd have set up this big group puzzle thing where you'd go from room to room and solve puzzles that would take you to sort of a treasure hunt, take you to a clue to another place. And I was infatuated by that idea. I think that stuff is great. And so we became friendly that way. And I think it's better to talk to someone as incredible as Stephen Sondheim about things other than his work, because I think he's probably dealing with people that tell him how great his work is and how amazing he is all the time. So I sort of tried to just talk to him about regular things that I liked, that I knew he liked as well. I'm so impressed by him in a structural way, because he writes music and writes vocal parts with very specific actors' thoughts in mind. Not just how they're going to say the words, but actual thoughts. He'll put a quarter rest instead of an eighth rest or a full bar's rest, because the character in his mind is taking time to think of what to say next. Or he'll repeat a stanza twice, and on the third time, the last note will raise up a third step. That's not just because he was bored, but he's actually thinking that the character on the third line is repeating to himself and then realizing something, and that realization would cause you to raise your pitch a third. So I think, not unlike Shakespeare, he maps out what the actor should do in his mind very specifically in what he does. And there's a lot of pattern in what he writes. And if you can wrap your head around that structure and really try and decipher it, then I think he hands you a better performance.
Would you apply what you just said to a Sondheim song that you've performed?
Yeah, like Not While I'm Around, that Tobias sings, has a bunch of weird minor thirds because he's in thought process and sort of confused by the whole thing, repeats himself a lot. In Evening Primrose, there's a great song, If You Can Find Me, I'm Here, mm-hmm. that sort of repeats itself a lot, but has little minor changes to it that are as he's walking around. And if he's startled by something, there's a, you know, 2-bar pause while he looks around before he commences again.
I'd like to play your song from Sweeney Todd, Not While I'm Around. And in your character in this, you're like the young apprentice of Mrs. Lovett, the character who bakes dead bodies into pies. And the dead bodies are the people that she and Sweeney Todd murder. And the pies become both a way of covering up the bodies and a way of selling cheap pies. And Tobias doesn't realize that Mrs. Lovett is in on these murders, so he sings her this beautiful song in the hopes that he can kind of warn her and protect her from Sweeney. Would you talk a little bit about this song and about any advice or insights that Sondheim gave you about it?
Sure. Tobias is a bit of a simpleton. You know, he was going around selling elixirs with another barber named Pirelli, and I sort of backstoried that he was beaten and abused and a little slow in the brain. Sweeney is a very vengeful, single-minded character who only wants revenge for being put in jail, and this judge who did that, he's trying to fix that wrong. Mm-hmm. And Mrs. Lovett is nothing but sort of wistful and a little kooky and sort of infatuated with Sweeney's passion. So Tobias witnesses Sweeney Todd being villainous, but he's sort of too simple to really put all the pieces together. He's not an incredibly articulate person. And his love and appreciation for Mrs. Lovett just comes on a more maternal way. He just never had anyone who was taking care of him be loving. It was always sort of awful and abusive. So Steve's notes to me were just to make sure that as you're singing the Tobias parts, that it's realizations that you're having at the moment. He's not someone who has a lot of foresight or is able to look back and put pieces together. So when he's singing things, he's really coming up with the thought and the idea while he's saying them. He knows that that there's something wrong in the room. He knows that Mr. Todd's probably involved and just not a good vibe, you know, because he's just a sort of young guy. And his desire to protect Mrs. Lovett doesn't come from anything that he knows, just something that he feels.
And also, this is a character who's actually kind of weak. He's not only, not very bright, but he's not particularly strong. He's not particularly big. He's not particularly.
It was originally done on Broadway by Ken Jennings, who is a very who's a smaller, diminutive kind of guy, and I'm 6 feet tall, so he was sort of the archetype that I had to go from. So I sort of added a bit of a limp. I twisted one of my feet in, sort of Kevin Spacey, Kaiser Soze style, and I sort of pitched my voice up a little Mandy Patinkin-ish and sort of gave him a bit of a hobble. So, because I didn't want to be physically imposing at all. In fact, I wanted to be a bit sympathetic physically, someone who's not capable of just standing himself up and making the right choice. He has to have others sort of make choices for him. And so I needed to sort of physicalize that and vocalize that. If you hear the song, you'll hear my voice is very, I'm kind of pingy the whole time. It's not how I normally sing.
May I say you're also doing a little hip-hop thing with your hands? Did you notice that?
Am I hip-hop?
Yeah.
I like to keep it real. You're throw a little gangster
yeah,
in there
yeah, exactly.
as well.
Yeah, exactly. You're doing slightly like hip-hop hands.
Word up.
Was that intentional?
Yes. I threw a little Puff Daddy in there as well. just for the youngsters. You got to play to every demographic, right?
Okay. So let's hear you in this production of Sweeney Todd, which was shown a couple of years ago on public television. And we're also going to hear Patti LuPone in the background.
Nothing's gonna harm you, not while I'm around.
Of course not, dear, and why should it?
Nothing's gonna harm you, no, sir, not while I'm around.
What do you mean, a man?
Demons are prowling everywhere nowadays.
And so they are, dear.
I'll send them howling, I don't care. I got ways.
Of course you do, but a sweet, affectionate child it is.
No one's gonna hurt you, no one's gonna dare.
I know what Toby deserves.
Others can desert you, not to worry, whistle, I'll be there.
Here, have a nice bonbon.
Demons will charm you with a smile for a while, but in time, nothing can harm you. Not while I'm around.
That's Neil Patrick Harris from a production of Sweeney Todd, the Stephen Sondheim musical.
It's so strange to hear those things because I'm not really a trained vocalist, so it brings me back to standing there at the New York Philharmonic at Avery Fisher Hall at Lincoln Center with that orchestra there and frigging Patti LuPone and George Hearn and all these amazing operatic people. And I sing okay, but I've not, you know, I didn't study for 6 years with some amazing person or anything. I have a vocal coach, but having started on television and then sort of veered into theater, it was definitely one of those pinch me, I can't believe I'm here moments.
How old were you when you auditioned for Doogie Howser, and how did you find out about the part and even consider auditioning for it?
Well, we never wanted to do TV. We, you know, I the first thing I did was a movie called Clara's Heart with Whoopi Goldberg, and that sort of came about through a gentleman named Mark Medoff, who's a playwright, and had he wrote Children of a Lesser God, and he wrote Clara's Heart. I went to a drama camp for a week at New Mexico State University, and Mark thought I'd be right to be in this movie. I ended up getting the movie and got an agent. So that's how my career started. And then we just never wanted to do television because it always would uproot us so much, you know. It was fun and fine to go away for 4 or 6 weeks to Big Bear and make a movie with Patrick Duffy and Lonnie Anderson and have a fun little summer and then go back to your regular life. But the conceit of doing a television show was just so all-encompassing. Both of my parents were attorneys, and it just seemed crazy to uproot us all. So there was one caveat. We said, well, if it's a really good TV show, if it's like a Stephen Bochco show, because my parents loved L.A. Law, being lawyers, loved Hill Street Blues, or if it's something really good like that, then we'll consider it. Well, sure enough, you know, a script comes down the pipe for a little precocious teenage doctor kid by Stephen Bochco, of all people. So we said we might as well read it. Or we might as well audition for it, I guess. And so I had sort of an in. The casting director of that show knew my manager, then agent Bo Shute, very well. And so he thought, you know, he already had sort of an inner track for it. So I got to go meet Stephen Bochco really before casting had even begun. And yeah, then sure enough, months later, they hadn't cast the role yet, and I went back in and re-auditioned and got the job, and we were indeed uprooted to L.A., and that was sort of how it happened. It was strange. Not many half-hour shows were one camera by someone who was so noted for doing long-form television like Stephen Bochco, so it was a bit of a hybrid show at the time, and it was a lot of work.
And you were what, 14?
No, a little bit older. I filmed the pilot when I was 15, and we started the series properly when I had just turned 16. So it was about 16 to 19.
So did the producers like interrogate you to make sure that you could handle, you know, emotionally handle being uprooted and doing television and becoming famous? Did they kind of give you some idea of how this might change your life? Because, you know, it's a big change for anybody, but for particularly like a 15-year-old, you know. So what did they do to prepare you or to test you beforehand?
Stephen Bochco did sit me and my parents down at a restaurant right when it all began and sort of said, look, this is going to be potentially a big chapter in your life and a big giant wave to ride. But he said, please know from experience that the business is not unlike sets of waves, and that you can ride one and it's a great ride, but suddenly it crashes on the sand and you have to stand up and shake yourself off and swim back out. And there might be a long period of time before another set of waves come, but trust that the business is lots and lots of waves that keep coming in. And if you can wait it out and hopefully hop on another wave later on, that'll be good. But, you know, I think he was more forewarning us that this wave that we were currently on would inevitably, you know, hit the shore, and that we shouldn't be so, you know, overwhelmed by that. And that was nice to hear. It actually put things in decent perspective.
So on Doogie, you were a teenage doctor, a really kind of precocious, overly smart kid who's already a doctor in a major hospital. So of all the impossible premises that the show had in its 3-year run, what was one of the ones that struck you as particularly ridiculous?
Well, I had to do some work on my girlfriend. I had to give her sort of an exam that would an intimate exam on a gurney hospital table that mortified her and me as well. That seemed kind of shocking. I think I did surgery on a dog, a stray dog, one time. That was something else. I don't know that would happen on Scrubs. That would probably happen on Scrubs.
So who came up with the name Doogie?
That was a friend of Stephen Bochco's, was named Douglas, and his nickname was Doogie, and I thought I think Stephen thought that that was a nice way to show an adult's world, but have a sort of child's name, you know, have adult responsibility, but still throw in sort of the adolescent skew, and to have a name like that, to have your parents call you Doogie while you're able to prescribe medicine and doing, you know, vasectomies and whatnot, seemed like a nice juxtaposition.
Was it hard after Doogie Howser to convince casting agents that you could be anybody else, that you could be somebody completely different, and that you could grow up?
Yeah, definitely. I think it's hard for anyone who's on a successful show, sort of known as a person, a specific person for a long time. It wasn't, you know, doors weren't slammed in my face, but I was really only thought of for a specific kind of role, and mostly on television. The crossover from TV to movies wasn't as widespread as it is now, and wasn't so welcoming. If you were a TV person, you were sort of doing movies of the week in your hiatus, as opposed to a cool independent film. But that was fine. They certainly paid the bills, and I have no complaints over how that all went. I understand that I want to direct. That's sort of my main aspiration, and I get it. You know, if I was directing a movie, a big blockbuster movie, I probably am not going to cast as the young lead a guy who was a really brainiac teenage doctor on TV for 4 years. That adds baggage that they don't. I would just assume hire someone who hasn't done much of anything before and try and make them a star. So I understand that logic, and I just kept thinking back to what Mr. Boshko said about, you know, waves will come when they will, and you just have to sort of be patient and ride them out. And, theater helped a lot with that, actually. The theater, the casting directors from the theater gave me the shot to play against type. You know, Mark in Rent was very against type, and the MC in Cabaret was this very androgynous, you know, crazy polysexual guy in Weimar Germany in the 20s, and that I would never have been thought for had that been a feature film or something. So I was sort of given the chance to expand the box and sort of spread my wings a little bit theatrically, I guess.
You had a very funny cameo as yourself in Harold and Kumar Go to White Castle. And they're driving in their car looking for the White Castle, and they pick you up hitchhiking, and they recognize you. But instead of being the Doogie Howser type, you're just obsessed with, like, scoring, you know, with finding with finding girls.
I'm tripping on ecstasy and
exactly.
Need to get to a strip club. Yeah.
Yes. So, and we can't play a clip of it because the language is totally unacceptable for radio. When you were offered this part, did you immediately say yes? Or, I mean, could you tell when they offered it to you whether the joke was supposed to be on you or with you, if you know what I mean?
I know exactly what you mean. That was the big question. I mean, I would love to separate myself and my image from the Doogie days, but at the same time, I really have incredible respect for the people that created that show. So at no time do I want to be trashing my past or making fun of the work that I've done. If not for me, for the people that spent a lot of time creating that show. So that was my worry was, great, you want to have this extreme kind of messed up version of Neil Patrick Harris. I'm down with that, but is it going to be at the expense of a bunch of bad Doogie Howser jokes and people sort of mocking that? I didn't know, and you never know with movies. They keep rewriting them as you make them.
So did Harold and Kumar change your image?
I think so. I don't know. I mean, I can't determine how my image is seen, but it certainly made me not look so square.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I was playing Neil Patrick Harris, but we also made sure that in the credits that it's Neil Patrick Harris as Neil Patrick Harris, not as himself. That I was playing the part of Neil Patrick Harris, who was this sort of, you know, crazy, you know, drug-induced, horny guy. So it was great. I worked for 2 days, and that was like it turned out to be a good thing. I think Harold and Kumar, that movie ended up getting me Barney and How I Met Your Mother, because without that, I don't think people would have expected me to be so extreme in that way.
Well, Neil Patrick Harris, one final question. 3 names, how come? why not Neil
Far
Harris?
More theatrical. I am a stage actor. No. 3 names. That's my birth name, and there was another Neil Harris in the Screen Actors Guild when we were signing the papers. So we thought about being someone like Neil Danger, or, you know, Neil Patrick Rocket. But we just figured the whole name would be nice for everyone involved. So it stuck.
Well, thanks a lot for talking with us.
Hey, my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Neil Patrick Harris stars in the CBS sitcom How I Met Your Mother.